The Context Conversation Series is brought to you by the new and expanded edition of How to Start a War, available as an audiobook. Listen to the story as originally intended, with entirely new, never-before-heard content, an additional chapter, better sound design, and a full audio remaster. In addition to listening to a more complete version of the story, you'll be supporting the creation of new stories, like How to Start a War, in the future. You can get the new audiobook at Audible, Apple Books, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you get audiobooks. What you're about to listen to is the first of what will be several conversations with a series of experts, historians, diplomats, and more, that will add new context to the events that took place in How to Start a War. You know, a big theme of the book is what if. Throughout the story, usually at the end of each chapter, a character is faced with a decision, usually an extremely difficult one. Should we put aside our principles to defend against a common enemy? Should we assume our adversary is operating in good faith? Should we appease a tyrant to avoid a war? And it's easy for us to ask, at each of these decision points, what if the decisions were made differently? How might things have turned out? Because with the benefit of hindsight, the answers to those questions seem obvious. If the conditions in Germany after the war during the Depression were not as desperate, we may not have seen the rise of such extremism in order to find a path towards stability. If President Hindenburg hadn't appointed Hitler as chancellor at the Nazi Party's moment of crisis, Hitler may never have come to power. And if British Prime Minister Chamberlain hadn't appeased Hitler at Munich, Hitler might have been knocked out in a localized war in Czechoslovakia, and World War II might have been avoided completely. But of course, those people who make the decisions at the time never have the benefit of hindsight that we have, and are usually faced with a great deal more of the practical realities of the situation on the ground as it's happening, with more context and baggage surrounding each of those decisions than someone looking back could ever have. This is why I believed it was so important for our first conversation of this series to be with my first guest. James Levy is an historian, an author, and professor at Hofstra University in New York. He has an enormous depth of knowledge about the period of time in between the two world wars. Some of his earliest works were focused on the British Royal Navy and its rearmament ahead of World War II. His second book took a candid look at the British government's strategy of appeasement towards Germany and challenged the traditional perspective that appeasement was simply a cowardly decision made by Chamberlain, and the obvious thing to do at the time would have been to stand up to Hitler, call his bluff. And if Hitler wanted war in Czechoslovakia, let him invade. Unite against him, attack Germany, and we could have taken out Hitler before World War II. Instead, Levy takes his vast knowledge of the interwar period and uses that context to paint a much more nuanced picture of the decision in front of the Allies. And in doing so, you begin to see that appeasement may not have been the so-called obviously wrong choice. And his argument is extremely compelling. And by the way, his new book, The Crisis of British Sea Power, The Collapse of a Naval Hegemon, just came out, and it's excellent. The stark transition from the largest naval power on Earth to gasping its last breaths of supremacy at the peak of a world war, I cannot recommend it enough. We're going to dig into all of these topics in this conversation. The state of the armed forces coming out of the Great War, the plans that each country had to rebuild its fighting forces, and then a real hard look at the idea of appeasement. The options that Chamberlain, Daladier, and the Allied democracies had in front of them, and really force ourselves to challenge our thinking. Were there really better options? What decision would you have made if you were in the same position? We'll have the discussion and then let you decide. As always, you can sign up for updates at howtostartawar.com or connect with me directly at howtostartawarpod on Instagram. James Levy, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you.
Well, so let's start a little bit about you, just your background. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your areas of study.
I went to Hofstra University as an undergrad. I was a history major and started my naval history work under Michael Simpson at the University of Wales at Swansea.
So let's dig into that topic, since it's such an area of expertise. Can you give us a brief overview of the Royal Navy at the time? And what was its reputation coming out of World War One? What was intact? What needed to be built? I think understanding a little bit of the thinking of what was the largest naval power in the world at the time will really help us set the stage for the rest of the conversation, but also add context to what the adversaries were seeing in that naval power at the time too. So give us a quick overview of what that Royal Navy was and what it was trying to accomplish.
Well, the Royal Navy comes out of the First World War tremendously strong. It's first in the world, and it's not close. And the Americans send their top of the line dreadnoughts over in 1918, and they make up one squadron of the six squadrons of battleships in the Grand Fleet. So the Americans are looking with very wide eyes. Ooh, we want one of those. We want a fleet like this. And but they're still although a very important power, they and Japan are now the second rung of powers. The German Navy is wiped out by the war, right? It's completely sur it's surrendered. The Navy scuttles itself rather than hand itself over. Germany, which had the number two navy in the world in 1914, has now been reduced to a non-entity as a naval power. They're out of the game. France had had to stop all of its naval construction during the war to keep the army afloat because the navy had become, France had always had a great navy, but the navy had become this vestigial organ of a country whose existential crisis is on land, not on the sea. France is no longer in the top rung of naval powers either, and so France is out as a possible enemy. Japan is allied to Great Britain in 1918. They had a formal treaty of alliance that went back to 1902, and there are British admirals who are very happy about this because they know the Americans are in a major building phase. Woodrow Wilson was a big Navy guy. Wilson had been gone in 1916 as his preparation for war had gone on a massive building spree. Congress had voted billions and millions of dollars to build new battleships. And Japan was also striving remorselessly to try and keep up. But Britain was very happy because the British were like, hey, as long as we're aligned with Japan, the Americans are split between having to fight in the Atlantic and having to fight in the Pacific. We can overwhelm them. We don't have to worry about it. That was the logic, at least, among the Navy guys in 1918, right? We're in good shape. The politicians, however, saw it very differently. They were dealing with the war debts, with a population that had, right, Britain, the First World War was much more devastating to Britain than the Second. You have to remember, 400 and some odd thousand Britons died in the Second World War. 785,000 British and Empire troops died in the First World. It was a much bigger deal. And so you have a population that is not interested in military spending. They want, Germany's defeated. There is no German Navy. The French are broke, and their fleet is not an issue anymore. It's hopelessly antiquated because they had to stop building battleships. But the politicians were like, we cannot antagonize the Americans. But the first great round of appeasement in the 19 between the wars was not appeasing Germany. It was appeasing the United States.
It's
Right,
fascinating.
the strategy among the political class in Britain was we've got to appease the Americans. Because if we get into a naval building race with them, if they really, really want it, they can break our economy. So what are we going to do? So what happens, what comes out of this whole process is the Washington Naval Conference in 21-22. Because you get a new government in the United States, but Harding is elected. Harding looks at the bill left over from Wilson's spending spree and projections of where they want to go with that. And he's like, I'm a Republican. I'm not raising taxes to pay for that. So he's like, we better get everybody together and we better talk about naval power. And what you get out of that is the big five, the United States and Britain, Britain's still number one, Britain and America and France and Italy and Japan come together. They have the five largest navies in the world to try and divvy it up. Right? We're gonna decide who gets what. And what the Americans want as the price of this is paper parity.
Can you
And the
talk
British.
real quick about what paper parity means?
Well, the Americans don't have a fleet as big as the British, but they
Okay.
want on paper to be allowed to have a fleet exactly as big as the British.
Got it. Makes
Right?
sense.
It's like it's this nationalistic thing. We really don't want to pay for this, but damn it, on paper we're going to be your equal.
Right.
You know, they're the we're just as good as you are. We're just as important as you are. We want a navy that's just as big as yours, even if we don't want to pay. And this is British naval thinking going into the appeasement period, because this is very important in the appeasement period. Because in the appeasement period, the idea is no war. Don't give us a war. Not before, in the British case, not before 1942. Under no circumstances should we get into a war before 1942. Because 1942 is the magic year where all the building that's going on in the late 1930s all comes online. All these battleships and all these aircraft carriers, all this stuff will be coming off the assembly line, to put it inaccurately. Yeah, they'll be coming out of the dockyards,
Right.
right, and onto the high seas, right? The German Navy has the same attitude. For God's sakes, Hitler, don't give us a war. We're not remotely ready until 1942. 44 would be even better.
Right.
That's kind of where the Royal Navy's at. It's still number one-ish in 1939. It's building more ships than anybody else in 1939. And so they're like, we're cool. We're fine. We're going to be okay. Politicians just don't jump the gun.
Let's dig into that too, because I'm interested in the domestic politics of Germany during the Depression and the pre-war period and in the late 1930s, of course. And we touch on it a little bit, especially as you look at things like France, which was very sort of had its own domestic political issues at the time. But it seems like just in general, the Great Depression, the post-war period, there's a lot of instability. There's a tenuous sort of internal domestic political dynamics. Can you talk a little bit about the domestic political states in the Allied democracies in the lead up to the war?
Well, you have, as I had pointed out, the Navy was the least controversial in the United States and in the United Kingdom,
Right.
right? You could spend money on the Navy. That didn't get, heckles up. The Army in both cases was a totally different story, right?
Right.
For a whole bunch of reasons. In the United States, it had to do at least as much with domestic politics as foreign policy. But in Britain, it had to do with the idea, which was very prevalent, which is if we don't give the politicians and the government a big army, they can't send it to the continent to get slaughtered in more battles of the Somme.
Yeah.
Okay, keep the army small. That's uncontroversial in Britain, right? They do not want a continental commitment. Spend money on the Navy, fine. Spend money on the Air Force, fine. Army, forget it. We don't want it. Don't, no, thank you. No, this was mirrored in the United States. It was easier to get money for the Navy and the Air Force than it was to get money for the Army until World War II breaks out. In Germany, you have the ongoing crisis of rearmament, which is you've got an economy that can give you a first-class army, a first-class navy, or a first-class air force, but not all three. And Hitler keeps wandering back and forth in his priorities between which one he wants to give primacy to. He's so angry over Munich because everybody thinks Munich was such a triumph for Hitler. Hitler hated Munich. Hitler hated multilateral negotiations. He wanted every negotiation to be a bilateral negotiation between Germany and one person or one power.
Right. And didn't he want to like demonstrate sort of the military capability, not in the large scale war, but at least the ability to test the military if he could?
Yes. And he saw Czechoslovakia as a great opportunity to do it. He had a long-running dislike of the Czechs that went back to his days in Vienna, and he thought very little of them. And they had performed very poorly in the Austro-Hungarian army in the First World War. The Czechs were prone to surrendering a lot. And so this was the impression that he had of the Czechs. And he was forced into that. He was forced into it, interestingly enough, by Mussolini.
Right.
And he can't break ties with Mussolini and throw them into the hands of the Allies. That would be bad. That'd be bad. So he's got to do it because Mussolini wants to show what a great statesman he is and how important he is. And Mussolini turns out to be important because the interesting thing about Munich is Mussolini speaks German, English, and French. He's talking to all to Daladier and to Chamberlain and to Hitler, and he's the guy it all runs around. And boy, does he love that.
Oh yeah.
He's the man of the hour. He's bringing peace to Europe by stepping in there and keeping these hot-headed people from, fighting a war.
Absolutely. And maybe this was just a show of the desperation of the time, but the dialogue between, or at least the message or the plea between Chamberlain and Mussolini sort of leading up to Munich, proposing that idea of like, hey, can you step in or can you say something to Hitler? Like, that it seems like the both of them, both Chamberlain and Mussolini, were just kind of thrilled that they dodged a bullet in their minds of being, of that full-on outbreak of the war.
Yeah, absolutely. They did not. They're like, we're not ready. I mean, Mussolini has been well, briefed by his military advisors. The war in Abyssinia and the ongoing support of the nationalists in Spain is really running down our military. We're low on everything,
Yep.
Our stocks of ammo are inadequate. The Navy's not ready. Another one with the Navy's not ready. Because Italy is actually in its own substantial building program. It's building four very good, modern, up to the state-of-the-art battleships. But none of them are ready. None of them are going to be ready until 1940 at the earliest one. And then they're going to cut basically come in 40, 41, 42. They want to avoid a war because it's not good for any of them. Hitler thinks it's good for him, but he's probably wrong.
Yeah.
But by 1938, he's just convinced that they're not ready, right? This is the old line of President Lincoln before the Battle of Bull Run. He's like, when they tell him, like, the army's not ready to fight a battle, forget it. And he's like, well, you're not ready, they're not ready, nobody's ready, give it a shot.
Yeah.
That's basically Hitler's attitude in 1938. Well, we're not ready, but they're not ready, let's give it a shot.
Hey, it's Michael. We're taking a quick break to listen to a trailer for the new and expanded edition of How to Start a War. I hope you like it. This is going to sound very different. From the immersive sound studio of Michael Trapani comes the telling of the dramatic series of events that led to the crime of the century, World War II, and the Holocaust.
Tonight, here in Berlin, we should have a decision whether it's to be peace or war.
Documenting the actions of the criminals who carried it out.
Food rationing and control of exports have now been introduced in many countries.
You will be in the room as history's most villainous characters plot to overthrow democracy, impose tyranny, and outmaneuver those who had the power to stop them.
There were reports today of a possible mediation by Mussolini.
Even more, you will hear the key factors that allowed these criminals to thrive, and how you can identify them in the world today.
Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns.
Combining captivating storytelling.
This day has placed us in a tragic and decisive situation.
With dramatic scenes using transcripts of actual conversations.
If I don't hear back from you within 1 hour, I'll assume it has been done.
This story is about what happens when good people do nothing to stop the worst people on Earth. While they still can.
And it's not necessary for me to say that the world is upside down tonight.
This is How to Start a War. Listen today, wherever you get audiobooks. Okay, and now, back to the conversation.
That sense of, you know, almost like a game of chicken is just in the air everywhere in the Munich crisis. And even, I think, probably right up until the actual outbreak of the war, because I think it's actually worth talking about that now. So, I mean, one of the cases that you've made in one of your books is talking about the appeasement strategy of the British government at the time. And we touched a little bit already in this conversation around why some of that appeasement strategy made sense to the British government. Why, in your words, did it seem like Britain was so eager to appease Hitler in the years leading up to the war? And was that purely military? Were there other implications there? I mean, you mentioned some of the political post-war attitudes of the citizenry. Talk a little bit about that.
People make the automatic assumption that this would have, a declaration of war would have been like 1914, where you have an overwhelming rallying of the peoples everywhere. Even in Germany, right? There's a famous anecdote about, you know, Hitler goes into Berlin on, I think it's the 3rd or the 4th of September.
Right, empty streets, right?
And the streets are empty.
Yeah.
Right? And he's like, what? You know, it wasn't 1914 all over again.
Right.
And if you can imagine that in a society like Nazi Germany, nobody was turning out to cheer. The attitude in Britain was even more hostile to war. Mm-hmm. The population was going to have to be convinced that, and very importantly, and this is also not taken into consideration, the only dominion which gave unqualified support in the Munich crisis to the government in London was New Zealand.
Hmm. That wasn't enough for them.
Sadly, the Kiwis were not quite enough. They were going to have to bring the Canadians and the Australians and the South Africans in on their side.
Right.
They could dragoon India into it.
Right.
But they didn't want to have to try to dragoon India into it. Because if India becomes a sore point, it's going to eat more troops than it's going to give you.
Yep. Yeah.
People don't realize that Canada declares war on Germany on September the 10th. They do not consider the UK declaring war on Germany in 1939 as bringing them into the war.
Hmm.
They decide we're going to vote our own declaration of war, right? The dominions are becoming much more self-consciously independent. That doesn't mean they're not pro-British. It doesn't mean they don't care. But their sensibilities have to be taken into account. And the idea that in 1938, right, before Hitler marches into Prague, before he invades Poland, they're going to just jump in happy-go-lucky. Oh, we're going to send all our men over to die for you in this war. It's not, the guys in London don't believe that it's necessarily going to happen. They hope so. They kind of are banking on it at some point, right? Because the empire part of the empire isn't very useful, except for some raw materials, right? The empire part of the empire is not really a source of great strength. It's the dominions that have the manpower that is willing to go, the money, and some of the industrial and production resource base that's going to give Britain an edge in a long war.
Yeah.
If we can get steel from Canada, if we can get wheat from Australia, if we can get there, and remember, coming out of World War I, the Canadians and the Australians were considered the best fighting men in the empire. Uh-huh. Right? They were the elite assault troops in 1918 when the British break the Hindenburg line. Who's leading the charge? Oh, the Canadian Corps. These guys are considered the best soldier material we've got. And we need them. We're going to need these dudes.
I wonder if we can double click on this for a second, because I think it's such an interesting question. And maybe it takes the form of a hypothetical. In my mind, I'm hearing things like, you know, the population wasn't ready. Domestic politics weren't ready. The post-war period was so devastating. The Great Depression was taking place. If you agree on the premise that the aggression towards the Sudetenland, the, you know, what was the topic of conversation of the Munich crisis, was the last, maybe the last moment when the Allied democracies could theoretically step in or enforce, you know, rejection of military occupation by the Germans. If it was maybe the last time that the Allied democracies could prevent that from happening without the outbreak of a major global conflict, as it ultimately did in 1939, like, do you think it was ever even possible for a population, maybe the citizenry of these democracies, to be more engaged if they knew what was ultimately going to come by not acting now, right? So, like, what ultimately happened was World War II and the largest, you know, human conflict in history, and the worst, you know, amount of death that humans had unleashed upon the earth at the time. What could have happened to get that political will to do the type of enforcement that might have been necessary to prevent a larger conflict?
You would have had to have somehow convinced them that, and this is why it's a hard sell, what is worth another 1914-1918 war. That's the sell, because people aren't stupid. They've gone up to bat against the Germans before. They know what it's going to mean.
Yeah.
Mass mobilization, big armies, battles, fighting, death, poison gas, nasty, ugly, blah, yeah, that's what's coming. It wasn't an abstract question. If you listen to somebody like Leo Amery or somebody who quit over it, right, to him it's a matter of honor, right? It's dishonorable. But the average British person is not going to go through 1914-1918 again because some upper class twit thinks it's dishonorable for us to give in to this upstart Bohemian corporal. They're just not going to do it. They have to have the idea that they eventually come to, which is There's nothing you could do with this man. Yep. You just have to fight him. But they haven't got there yet. They're going to get there, but they're going to get there kicking and screaming because they know what's coming, right? The military historian Gwyn Dyer once said, you know, in 1940, nobody knew what was coming. In 1938, they knew exactly what was coming, except it was 1914, 1918 with strategic bombing, which they were terrified of. The air forces are feeding into this. The air forces are playing a strange game. The RAF is telling the government in the mid-30s, famously, the bomber will always get through. There is no realistic defense against the bomb. There are people who don't agree with that, and they get, interestingly enough, that's a big difference between Chamberlain and Churchill. Churchill wants bombers, build more bombers. We're going to deter Germany by threatening to wipe them out. Chamberlain doesn't listen to that. Chamberlain listens to the guys who says, we need radar and fighter planes.
Mm.
Right? The reason why Britain has radar and fighter planes in 1940 is because Chamberlain decided in 1937 that that's what they were going to have.
Wow. What an advantage that turned into in the war itself.
Yes, because the bombers they would have been building in the mid-1930s would not have amounted to much of anything. But the concept was there, right? Churchill is simply reflecting a notion that is very popular at the time, which is the bombers will get through. They're going to drop poison gas, right? The British government is preparing for enormous casualties, enormous civilian casualties. They're expecting casualties in the hundreds of thousands in the first 60 days of a new war.
Wow.
In 1938, during the Munich crisis, they're issuing gas masks.
Right. Yeah, they're digging trenches in Hyde Park.
Right. Because they think the bombers are going to get through. So you've got 1914, 1918 memories of Passchendaele combined with the bombers are going to come through and they're going to drop gas on us and they're going to kill our children. You got to make a massive sell to convince people that, oh, yeah, let's go to war over the Sudetenland.
Isn't that the sell, though? Isn't it like if you don't want 1918, 1914, 1918 to happen again, this is how we nib it in the butt, right? Like the idea of, and who knows how convincing that is. It's probably not. And that's why, you know, maybe they made that calculation of like, we can make that sell. No one's going to believe it. And maybe they didn't know, although you're saying a lot of the generals at the time saw this potentially coming, but wouldn't the sell be, if you don't want World War One, the Great War, to happen again, this is our last chance?
I understand that argument on some level, but on another level, I don't, because that's built on the idea that you could knock Germany out very quickly from a standing start.
Mm.
Because it's not like Germany's not prepared to fight. We know Hitler wanted to fight. The Allies do not have the capacity to, they don't in 1940, for God's sakes, have the capacity to launch a knockout blow. That's not the strategy. The strategy was set up during the First World War. We blockade Germany. We mobilize the British and French empires, all our economic resources. We absorb the German attack. And then in year three, we go on the offensive.
Mm.
That's the strategy. These are not societies with large offensive military capability. Britain has no offensive military capability. And the French, the entire French armed forces are designed to defend the homeland.
That's right.
They're not designed to attack. They are, that is not the idea, right? They tried that in 1914, right? They went right into the offensive.
Yep. Right.
People, again, you can't, these people were alive in 1914. They remembered what happened, right? They went charging into Alsace-Lorraine and got slaughtered. The worst losses the French army took in the war were the losses they took in the first 6 weeks.
Yep.
They got massacred. They're not doing that again. This time we're going to let the Germans come at us. And we'll slaughter them this time. That's what they're thinking. These are men whose entire lives were shaped by the 1914-1918 war. And so that's their image of reality. You could argue they were wrong, but structurally they were already committed to a view of the next war. They had been for years. That meant we're going to beat the Germans the same way we beat them the last time. We're going to let them beat their brains against us. And then eventually we're going to go over to the, we're going to mobilize all our resources. We're going to go over to the counterattack. And after a blockade and then a bombardment of their industries with our air forces, they're going to collapse. Yeah. They did it in 1918. Why not again? And in fact, most people thought that the Hitler government was much weaker and commanded less of the people's loyalty than the Kaiserreich had.
Right.
This was just an upstart government. This wasn't an ancient monarchy, right? The idea was, you know, after a few years, the German people are going to like, this is insane, and they're going to get rid of Hitler. Hey, if they could do it to the Kaiser, why couldn't they do it to Hitler? Happened before. It'll happen again, right? They're basic. They're people. People look at the past. They look at their experience. They, I guess that'll happen again,
right?
And they have their prejudices, right? To them, the Hitler government was kind of a joke.
Yep.
British and French people in 1914 didn't see the Kaiser's government as a joke. Not at all. They took it very seriously. They figured it commanded the people's loyalty the way that nationalists believed that, you know, people in Britain would rally around the king. People in France would rally around the Republic. People in France did rally around the public. People in Britain did rally around the king. So these were natural ways of viewing the world.
Absolutely.
So it's hard to see how they were going to completely imagine a totally different reality.
Yeah. It's dramatic irony, right? It's tragic to, you know, with the perspective of hindsight, where you can look back and again, it's totally theoretical, this idea of instantly shifting a years-long strategy and approach towards a war, turning a defensive armed force into an offensive one, erupting over the Maginot Line into, you know, the Rhineland and attacking Germany from the rear while they're pinned up in the Sudetenland, you know, mountains defenses and trying to cut them off with a knockout. But it's a fascinating thought experiment, but really interesting to hear the practicalities which everyone going through these types of decisions in power has to consider, and it really speaks to the realities of a situation. I'm wondering if we could touch a little bit, as we're, you know, thinking about the domestic politics. One of the things that I think a lot of folks who are, you know, interested in World War II, but maybe haven't dug super deep into the topic, I think one of the first thing that surprises a lot of them in German politics is just how powerful socialism was as a concept, and in particular, the Communist Party being the second most powerful, party in the Reichstag. You know, the street wars between the SA and the communists at the time, and I think the fear that a lot of the capitalist governments at the time had that communism might take over, you know, their countries like it did in Russia. How did the rising popularity of socialism in different parts of the world at the time factor into the thinking and the decisions made around this time in the lead up to the war?
They certainly have some impact. And it's different in different places. I think it's much more of a problem in France than it is in Britain. For whatever reason, the French propertied class is simply a lot more reactionary than the British propertied class in this period. And you have the confluence of a bunch of things, right? You have the confluence of deep anti-communism, which goes much further than anti-communism. It's a hostility to the working class.
Mm.
Communist or non-communist. it this is in France. I'm not talking about Britain. And it's and you have the issue of anti-Semitism, which on the French right is much stronger than it is on the British. Hitler's anti-Semitic rhetoric and policies are viewed much more sympathetically in France than they are in Britain. And the fact, and this is all compounded by the fact that, of course, who becomes prime minister in this period? Leon Blum, a Jewish man who's a socialist, who's a moderate. He's not some kind of bomb-throwing wacko. I mean, he's like Eugene Vitebs. I mean, he's not a crazy person. He's not a revolutionary. He's a reformist. But you know, and I know that the rhetoric around these things can just simply separate from reality pretty quickly. And so the idea among certain elements in French society, you know, better Hitler than the Jew Blum, right, was real. Right? Wow. It was there. So at a critical point, you have this deep division in French society, which is exacerbated by the Spanish Civil War. This terrible thing, it's exacerbated by the anti-Semitism issue, and it really messes up things in France in the period 36-38. And of course, the Republican government would love to help the Republicans in Spain, but basically, you have the people on the left of that coalition are furious that the government won't lift a finger to help the Republicans. And then you have the more moderate people around Blum who are saying, we'd love to do it, but we don't know what the consequences are going to be here at home. We could have terrorism. We could have armed revolts. We could have civil war. So we've got to just sit it out and let the Republicans get strangled, you know, while Hitler and Mussolini are pouring money and pouring aid, military equipment in to help. They're right. That causes all kinds of bad blood in France, which the extent to which the divisions are healed by the declaration of war in 1939 are real, but not complete.
Yeah.
Whereas in Britain, their distaste for communism is out among the property class is absolutely real, but they're dealing with the Labour Party, which is assuredly not a communist organization. So it sets up a different kind of dynamic. Although what to do about the Soviet Union and how to work that into the plan of dealing with Germany or to work it in at all is also controversial in both countries. Should we cut a deal with Stalin to contain Germany? Or should we kind of nudge Germany in the direction of, why don't you attack the Russians? Why don't you go to war over there? Leave us alone. Go fight the commies. You two can kill each other and we'll be happy.
Do you think that's why the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, right? The ultimate agreement that they do make, which I firmly believe is almost a permission structure to invade Poland and divvy it up. Do you feel, but at the same time, Britain was in conversations. They were sending an envoy over to Stalin to have their own type of alliance negotiations or pact negotiations. But it felt like they were slow rolling it. They weren't sending as senior folks over to those types of conversations with Russia as Germany was. Is that sort of the reason why is that conflict internally around how to deal with Russia in this context?
It's certainly partly the case. It's also the case of what can you give them?
Yeah, right.
You're allied with Poland, right? Britain has already guaranteed the territorial integrity of Poland. This was a huge step, right? Chamberlain goes on the radio, Poland's territorial integrity is inviolate. You attack Poland, you attack us.
Yep.
How do you then turn around and say to Stalin, it's okay, you take one third of Poland,
right,
as the price of the alliance? You can't do it, right? It would bring down the government.
Yeah.
because the not only the British people, but the British Parliament would lose its mind. And Chamberlain is much more dependent on Parliament than modern PMs are, because this Parliament, especially in the Conservative Party in the 1930s, is still filled with notables. Right. Yeah. These are dudes, and they're all dudes. Right. These are all men who are of independent means. Right. They are not party hacks.
Yeah.
Right. These are the younger sons of the aristocracy. These are members of the gentry. These are the sons of industrialists and bankers. They expect to be consulted. You don't just point your finger and say, this is what we're doing. And you got a bunch of party hacks who go,
yeah,
absolutely, Prime Minister, absolutely. No. Doesn't work that way. He's got to work the cabinet, and he's got to work. Even Churchill had to work the cabinet and work Parliament. He was very good at it, better than he thought he was going to be. Churchill did it by rhetorically taking them into his confidence. He would have these secret meetings of Parliament. They weren't secret in that nobody knew that we were meeting, but everybody would be thrown out of the building, and he would tell them, oh, everybody, this is what we're working on, this is what we're doing, and only you know this very important information, and you will understand that this is vital. And everybody, oh, yes, Prime Minister. Right. That was a different deal. Right. Chamberlain doesn't have that working for him because the war isn't on yet. He's still got a whole bunch of, Sir John blah, 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 baronet of whatever, who's sitting there saying, you're going to sell out the Poles, sell out Poland. What kind of unsavory business is this? And they're not going to go for it.
Yeah.
So, but Hitler can give it all away. Hitler can give, you want Bessarabia? Take Bessarabia. What the hell do we care? Have fun. You want the Baltic states? We don't have the Baltic states. We don't care about the independence of small republics. Take them.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a completely asymmetrical bargaining position. It's not just that the British and the French are kind of holding their nose and trying and sending a full admiral and a full general over to talk to the Russians about a possible alliance. It's that, what are we going to give them, and do we want to give them anything? Don't they see that it's in their interests to keep Hitler bottled up? That's what they're thinking. They're like, by this point, that they think it should be pretty obvious to everybody that Hitler is not very trustworthy and that you want to keep him bottled up. But Stalin sees the Germans are like, you want a third of Poland? We'll give you a third of Poland. You want the Baltic states? You want Bessarabia? Take them. Fine with us. We don't care. Hey. It's just this smorgasbord of things that Stalin wanted really badly, right? To restore the old Russian imperial boundaries, right? Ask Mr. Putin about this, right? Russian leaders want those old boundaries. Chinese leaders want those old imperial boundaries, right? They claim them. That's ours.
Yeah, it was just something that the British government just couldn't give. And it's interesting that deference, if you call it that, to Parliament at the time was so obvious in, even in the invasion, once the invasion does take place in September of 39, when Chamberlain and his cabinet is trying to coordinate with France to make the joint declaration towards Germany, and France is kind of not moving as quickly as the British are. And
you go first. You go first.
Right. And then I think Britain responded to, like, France had something, they said something like, we're going to wait until tomorrow at noon for the time to expire. And then we're going to send them something 3 hours later. And I think the response from the foreign minister was, we do not believe that we will have a government by noon tomorrow if we do not respond at the time, right? We will have already have a no confidence vote. And yeah, it's fascinating. I know we're sort of at the end of our time, but I'd love for you to share, apart from your own books, what are some of your favorite books on these topics that you'd recommend to the audience? Any, you know, one or two that you found meaningful to you?
There's a really good book called Alternatives to Appeasement, where I believe the author is Stedman, and he tries to honestly say, okay, I think he lays out 8 possibilities, right? Different things that could have been done. And he tries to follow through as best he can based on the time, what would happen. They all lead to war. Mm. Everyone. there's no way. The problem is there's no way around the war. And Alternatives to Appeasement is very, very good. Joe Maiolo's book, Cry Havoc, which is on the arms race of the 1930s, is fantastic. Really good book. I would say those would be two that pop out. Joe and I don't agree on some things. Certainly we don't agree on some things, but totally serious book, totally worth reading.
Excellent. Well, the book is The Crisis of British Sea Power, The Collapse of a Naval Hegemon. It's available today. James Levy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the Context Conversation Series and our first guest, James Levy. The Context Conversation Series is brought to you by the new and expanded edition of How to Start a War, available wherever you get audiobooks. If you'd like to stay in touch, you can follow on Instagram, How to Start a War Pod, or reach out to me directly at michael@howtostartawar.com. Thanks, and you'll hear again from me soon with the next exciting conversation.